Blog Talk Radio.
Healing rain is coming down. It's coming nearer to this old town. Rich and poor, weak and strong. It's bringing mercy. It won't be long. Healing rain is coming down. It's coming closer to the lost and found. Tears of joy and tears of shame are washed forever in Jesus' name.
Good morning and welcome to The Cross in the Desert, speaking hope and freedom to Iran. My name is Randy L. Noble. I'm your host, and it's a very nice Monday, the last day of March, March 31st. Hopefully, most of us are unfrozen by now, and spring is becoming a real reality. It's so great to be with you on this Monday morning. Got a very special program today, a little bit different from maybe the kinds of programs that you expect, but nonetheless very important. In the last month, there has been a rash of really good Christian films that have come out. Honor Diaries, Veil of Tears just released, and of course the Son of God movie, and just last week, God's Not Dead, the Newsboys movie, and I'm going to see this movie today, but I've heard a lot about it, and I decided what I would do today on The Cross in the Desert is play the movie trailer and give you a little background, and then build on the themes of the movie. Basically, the movie is about a college student in his philosophy class. And the philosophy professor comes in at the beginning of class and instructs everyone in the class to write down on their paper the conclusion that God is dead. There's no argument. There's no need to even discuss this. And he tells them emphatically, unless you do this, I'm going to fail you. Well, this character in the movie stands up and says, I can't do that, professor. Well, what ensues after that is that he becomes involved in a debate with the professor, and he must win this debate or he will fail the class. Well, this is what the movie is based on, arguments for God's existence, giving reasons for the hope that lies within us. And so I'm enjoying this theme very much, and today on The Cross in the Desert, we're going to develop this theme, flesh it out a little bit for you, because I think it is so important for us as Christians to give reasons for our faith. Now, that doesn't mean that when we talk and engage unbelievers that our arguments and reasons is going to save them. We're not saying that. The Bible's not saying that. It simply means in this world of uncertainty and skepticism, questions from those that are unbelievers, we have a responsibility and a passion, I would say, even more importantly, to give reasons for our faith. Sometimes in giving those reasons, we remove a lot of roadblocks in the minds of people. I know I've been doing apologetics almost since I became a believer. I find it a fascinating, important field. I can look back in history and see some of the great apologists giving reasons for their faith. And I think that there's a history to apologetics that's so important. Recently, I just thought about this when I heard about the film God's Not Dead, that really this is the responsibility of the church to go out into the marketplace, that is everyday life, where we encounter those that are skeptics or unbelievers. And in our lifestyle, the best apologetic we can give them is the way we live for Jesus. That, I know, is the most important thing. But in that, lifestyle, we also have a responsibility to answer questions. Now, some of us feel a little timid about that. We don't know what to say. Well, that's why I'm doing this program today. This is a program to possibly ignite a passion in you and to give you some equipment, if you will, some solid information that you can use in your everyday life as you talk to the unbeliever. And I think that a movie like God's Not Dead, which I'm going to see today, would probably be an excellent starting place for most of us. Not all of us can engage maybe in apologetics or maybe feel the need to do so, but there are things we can learn from films like this that will help us in giving answers for the hope that lies within us. You know, that is the teaching of Scripture, that's our responsibility, and the primary verse for that is 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 15. And Peter writes, "Instead, you must worship Christ as Lord of your life. And if someone asks about your Christian hope, always be ready to explain it. But do this in a gentle and respectful way. Keep your conscience clear. Then if people speak against you, they will be ashamed when they see what a good life you live because you belong to Christ." So if someone asks, be ready to explain it and respect. This is the primary text for apologetics, giving answers. And so I hope that clears the way for you as you think about talking about God in the marketplace every day. Well, I want to keep you updated on the latest information that I have from NAGMA on Facebook about the situation with Saeed. Nowruz is drawing to a close, and we will know by April 2nd, just 2 days from today, whether Saeed is on the list of prisoners in Iran to be released. There is a list that comes out right at the end of Nowruz, and we are praying that this is the week, the last week, Saeed will have to tell you some good news within what I just shared with you. NAGMA writes in her latest status, Saeed remains in a private hospital in Tehran. Close family members have been allowed some visitation. Although he looks very skinny, he is feeling much better thanks to all of your prayers and being able to be in a better environment where he has been able to have good food, that is meat, hot showers, and bed for the first time in almost 2 years. Saeed continues to shine for Jesus in the hospital and has been a great witness. Thank you for your prayers. NAGMA continues to write, we should know by April 2nd if Saeed will be granted clemency for the Iranian New Year. New reports coming out of Iran show resistance and conflict within the Iranian government since the new Iranian president has taken office. That was 9 months ago. Human rights violations have worsened, and prisoners were not granted the promised furloughs that had been granted in the previous years under Ahmadinejad. NAGMA closes in her status, our family would appreciate your continued prayers for Saeed's health and release, for open doors for the gospel for Saeed and for me as I travel, and for our children who desperately miss their daddy. Love you all, NAGMA. This is so important that we keep the message of Saeed's plight for freedom on the internet, Twitter, Facebook, wherever you want to put it. Keep this story alive. Keep the pressure on Iran. Keep our prayers going. This is so important. Now, speaking of Saeed, I also want to mention to you, there is a young 26-year-old girl named Rahana Jabari who is scheduled to be executed. Her crime? Defending herself against a rapist. This crime took place over, I would imagine it was about 6 or 7 years ago. She was contracted to help a man with interior design of his office, to redo his office. She was driven to his office. This man was an Iranian intelligence person, by the way, too. He took her into the home where the work was to be done. And she noticed when she walked in there was a table and chairs and two cups sitting on the table. When she was brought in the house, according to her story, he closed, locked the door behind her, and began to physically assault her and rape her. She responded by grabbing a knife and stabbing him in the shoulder and fleeing the scene as quickly as she could. As a result, this man died of bleeding to death, basically. And now, because of this, Rahana Jaberi faces execution. It's almost unthinkable that a woman cannot defend herself against a rapist. But this is the culture of Iran. This is the culture in most Middle Eastern countries. When a woman is raped, she brings honor, shame to her community, and oftentimes she, that is the victim, is punished for what was done to her. And this is unthinkable in our Western mindset, but this is what goes on. There is a petition on my Facebook about Rahana Jaberi. I urge you, please go to my page, scroll down, and sign this petition. Our voice, our prayers, our speaking out, you know it makes a difference. And time is of the essence for Rahana. I urge you, please go to my page. It is the most important thing you can do to stand in the gap for someone whose life is in danger, like Rahana. So thank you so much for going to my page, and thank you so much for please signing that petition. Those are the latest updates on Saeed and also Rahana. What I want to do now is I want to transition. Our program today is about the movie God's Not Dead, and what I want to do right now is play you a clip from that particular movie, On the Cross in the Desert. Let's listen.
You prayed and believed your whole life, and here you are. Explain that to me.
In a few minutes, you guys are going to go out there and sing about God and Jesus as if they're as real as you and me.
They are as real. When a 12-year-old watches his mother dying of cancer, God who would allow that is not worth believing in. Life is really a tale told by an idiot full of sound and fury and signifying nothing.
Name? Wheaton. Josh Wheaton. Philosophy 150. You might want to think about a different instructor. Come on, man. It can't be that bad.
Think Roman Coliseum. People cheering for your death.
I am Professor Radisson. This is Philosophy 150. I would like to bypass senseless debate altogether and jump to the conclusion, which every sophomore is already aware of, there is no God.
All that I require from each of you, that you fill in the papers I've just given you with three little words: God is dead. Wheaton, is something wrong?
I can't do what you want. I'm a Christian.
If you cannot bring yourself to admit that God is dead, then you will need to defend the antithesis.
I think of Jesus as my friend. You think Jesus is God. I don't want to disappoint him.
So your acceptance of this challenge may be the only meaningful exposure to God and Jesus they'll ever have.
It's me. He's not dead. I don't want anyone to get talked out of believing in him just because the professor thinks they should.
Mr. Wheaton, are you ready?
We're going to put God on trial.
You think you're smarter than me, Wheaton? In that classroom, there is a God, and I'm him.
This experiment is over. You get to decide who the most important person in your life is. Me, Professor Radisson.
I have to do this thing. Like it's something that God wants me to do. I can't just turn away from it.
You just want to ensnare them in your primitive superstition.
What I want is for them to make their own choice. That's what God wants.
You have no idea how much I'm going to enjoy failing you.
Yeah, but who are you really looking to fail? Me or God?
God's not dead. He's surely alive. He's living.
Supports his existence. You know the truth. So why do you hate him? It's a very simple question. Why do you hate God?
God's not dead. He's surely alive. He's living on the inside.
Well, this really looks like an exciting, inspiring movie, and I'm looking forward to seeing it today. I like movies like this because we live in a culture of ungodliness, of unbelief, where many of the times unbelievers get most of the attention for the arguments they have that are meaningless and hopeless. I can think of science classes. I can think of those that are scientifically minded who believe that evolution is the cause of everything. And with all of this data swirling around us on the internet, in the classroom, wherever it's at, we have a responsibility to tear down strongholds. The Bible talks about these worldviews, these atheistic worldviews, you know, like Richard Dawkins and then the late Christopher Hitchens. These are worldviews. These are strongholds which vie for our attention every day. Now, you may say, well, Randy, you know, it's a no-brainer. There is a God. I don't have to have all the fancy arguments to show and demonstrate that. Well, and you are right in many ways, but I do believe we need to stand up to the academia, to the classroom professor. And we're doing it not to be showing us who we are. We're doing it to give a voice for the truth. We're doing it to give a voice for the Christian worldview. And I see this as something very important in our day and age. And there's no excuse, the Bible said, for someone to say there is no God. It's very plain. The fingerprints of God are everywhere. In the DNA, you can't mistake DNA. When you look at it under the microscope as a scientist, how can you say that this is the result of time and chance and random processes? DNA is what programs our hair color, our body, everything that makes us human. DNA is like a library of information in our cells buried deep beneath the surface, but nonetheless, the fingerprints of God is there. But yet because unbelievers choose to live apart from God, unbelievers choose to live as they choose, and in order to justify their lifestyle, they have to have, quote, a scientific reason for being an unbeliever, when in reality, it's an excuse to live as they choose. And they hide behind this scientific worldview. Let me say to you, the best refutes the atheistic scientific worldview is the case for the Creator, Lee Strobel, the case for the Creator. It is an amazing book filled with interviews. Lee Strobel was one time an atheist. He was a journalist and a reporter for the Chicago Sun-Times, I believe, and he took the challenge of investigating the evidence for the case for Christ, for the case for a creator, and through the evidence, through his journey, through his search, he became a believer, a strong voice in the Christian community today. Lee Strobel is that man. Well, in the movie God's Not Dead, this young man is challenged to demonstrate to this professor his worldview. If it's true, the professor will pass him. But more importantly here than a passing grade is this young man's refusal to bend the knee to this claim that there is no God and just sign the paper like everyone else. He is going to stand up and give reasons for the hope that lies within him. So I love this movie. Even though I haven't seen it yet, I know it's good. And this should be an admonition to you and me when we are challenged to not be afraid to stand up and be a voice for God, to give reasons for faith. Well, you may ask the question, well, Randy, where do I begin? There are many ways. And what I want right now is help you with some argumentation for the Christian worldview. The question, does God exist, is kind of a mute question. There are those that ask it. How do you know that God exists? Well, let's go to the world of cosmology. What is that? The universe, the observable universe, and let's reason from the universe. This is a particular argument. I want you to listen carefully, and if you listen carefully, I think you'll get it. This is a historical argument for the existence of God that you might find helpful, if you listen to it carefully, that you can use next time. So let's listen to what's called the Kalam cosmological argument right now on the cross in the desert.
Does God exist? Or is the material universe all that is, or ever was, or ever will be? One approach to answering this question is the cosmological argument. It goes like this. Whatever begins to exist has a cause. The universe began to exist, therefore, the universe has a cause. Is the first premise true? Let's consider. Believing that something can pop into existence without a cause is more of a stretch than believing in magic. At least with magic, you've got a hat and a magician. And if something can come into being from nothing, then why don't we see this happening all the time? No, everyday experience and scientific evidence confirm our first premise. If something begins to exist, it must have a cause. But what about our second premise? Did the universe begin, or has it always existed? Atheists have typically said that the universe has been here forever. The universe is just there, and that's all. First, let's consider the second law of thermodynamics. It tells us the universe is slowly running out of usable energy, and that's the point. If the universe had been here forever, it would have run out of usable energy by now. The second law points us to a universe that has a definite beginning. This is further confirmed by a series of remarkable scientific discoveries. In 1915, Albert Einstein presented his general theory of relativity. This allowed us, for the first time, to talk meaningfully about the past history of the universe. Next, Alexander Friedman and Georges Lemaître, each working with Einstein's equations, predicted that the universe is expanding. Then in 1929, Edwin Hubble measured the red shift in light from distant galaxies. This empirical evidence confirmed not only that the universe is expanding, but that it sprang into being from a single point in the finite past. It was a monumental discovery, almost beyond comprehension. However, not everyone is fond of a finite universe, so it wasn't long before alternative models popped into existence. But one by one, these models failed to stand the test of time. More recently, three leading cosmologists, Arvind Bord, Alan Guth, and Alexander Vilenkin, proved that any universe which has on average been expanding throughout its history cannot be eternal in the past, but must have an absolute beginning. This even applies to the multiverse, if there is such a thing. This means that scientists can no longer hide behind a past eternal universe. There is no escape. They have to face the problem of a cosmic beginning. Any adequate model must have a beginning, just like the standard model. It's quite plausible then that both premises of the argument are true. This means that the conclusion is also true. The universe has a cause. And since the universe can't cause itself, its cause must be beyond the space-time universe. It must be spaceless, timeless, immaterial, uncaused, and unimaginably powerful. Much like God. The cosmological argument shows that, in fact, it is quite reasonable to believe that God does exist.
I hope that was helpful to you. Now, some of you are probably going, you mean I got to remember this? Well, let's look at some of the basic things outlined in this premise. Something that comes to be has to have a cause. Otherwise, we're saying that something pops into existence by magic, like the rabbit out of the hat. And I think logically we can say that's not true. So everything that begins to exist must have a cause. The next premise is the universe had a beginning, and the point being that science has to admit that the universe is not eternal, that it had a beginning, quote-unquote, the Big Bang. So if everything that begins to exist has a cause, and the universe popped into existence, therefore the Big Bang, then the universe has to have a cause. Now, what's the cause of the universe? Well, there has to be a cause greater than the universe, more powerful to bring it into existence. And I think the point being in this argument is that sufficient logical reason to believe that there is a first cause. And that first cause has to be eternal and unchangeable and all-powerful to bring about the universe. Now, I think that's a good logical argument for the existence of God. And I think the more that you read apologetics, you read the arguments, you will see that we have at our disposal good answers to the atheists. Now, of course, this is just one of many, many arguments. There's the argument from morality, the argument from design, And what am I mean by that? Let me give you an example. Let's go with the argument design. You've seen the statues of the president probably on pictures or on movies or even in person of Mount Rushmore, and the president's there. Well, very interesting point to make. Are we to believe those carefully sculptured heads of the president at Mount Rushmore simply were the product of millions of years of erosion and evolution, that they just happened by chance? Well, that's absurd. A painter makes a painting, and a sculpture makes the heads of the president. The point being, it was designed. It didn't just happen by chance in millions of years of erosion. So I think you're getting the point that it takes more faith to be an atheist, to believe that millions of years of erosion in wind and weather conditions can result in the sculptured heads of the presidents at Mount Rushmore. Well, you say that's absurd. Well, that's what atheism is asking you and I to believe, that intelligent design just happened out of nothing. Of course, that really is absurd. Now, what I want to do, since you heard this argument, I want to flesh out this argument for you today. And we're going to go to a short debate between J.P. Moreland and Edward Tabash. And the question is the supernatural real? And we're going to get a little bit more insight into this debate. Now, don't be discouraged if some of the terms are a little complex at first. These are important things for you to listen to, and it will help you in coming to a good reasoned defense of the Christian faith. Now, you may not get it all in one setting, but listen to it many times. And the reason I'm doing this program is because I think, like the movie, God's Not Dead, we have a responsibility to speak the truth. So let's listen to this debate. The question is the supernatural real? And it's featuring J.P. Moreland and Edward Tabash right here on the cross in the desert. Let's listen.
Whether it's God, the human soul, or life after death, faith is often based on a belief in the supernatural. But is it logical and reasonable to believe that the supernatural does indeed exist? Or is it the spiritual equivalent of a fairy tale? I mean, that is a perfect topic for a debate on Faith Under Fire. And so on one side, we have Dr. J.P. Moreland, philosophy professor at Talbot Theological Seminary in La Mirada, California, and author of the book Scaling the Secular City. And on the other side is Edward Tabash, an attorney, a skeptic, and a member of the board of directors for the Council of Secular Humanism. Okay, JP, since you're sort of making the affirmative case here, what evidence do you have that the supernatural is real?
Lee, in the last 25 years, the evidence for the supernatural has been so overwhelming that the leading defender of atheism, intellectual philosopher Tony Flew, for 60 years has been the top defender of atheism, has this last year become a believer in the supernatural and in God.
Really?
And the reason he has done so has not been because he wanted the supernatural to be true, but because of the evidence. Three strands of evidence were most important for Flew. First, we now know, according to the Big Bang Theory, that the natural world of space, time, and matter has begun to exist at some time in the past. And as Ted Koppel said on Nightline, bangs have bangers. The second piece of evidence that we have is the fact that there are at least 50 constants of nature. A constant of nature would be like the mass of a proton, the charge of an electron, the force of gravity in the universe. If any one of these 50, much less all 50, were different, larger or smaller, on the order of a billionth of a percentage point, there would be no life whatsoever in the universe. And as theoretical physicist Paul Davies said, it looks like the dice were rigged in advance for life to appear. Bangs have bangers and rigged dice have riggers. Finally, the search for extraterrestrial intelligence is a search that bases its work on the assumption that information can only come from an intelligent mind. But the number one discovery of 20th century biology was that the thing that constitutes living organisms is libraries filled with information. The thing that makes something living is that it is pregnant with information, and information comes from an informer. So Anthony Flew and a number of others are becoming believers in the supernatural because of the evidence. Bangs have bangers, information has an informer, and rigged dice has a rigger.
And you're saying this information is found in DNA, is that correct?
It is found in DNA and the genetic code, which is information-rich, information-bearing.
Okay, Eddie, that's a good statement of the evidence. What is your position?
There's absolutely no evidence in our physical universe, nothing empirically amenable to us, nothing that can be scientifically ascertained that in any way shows that there is anything beyond and above the universe that's not a part of the universe, and there's nothing that shows that there is any force in the universe that can violate the laws of nature. The problem with claims of the supernatural, which is equivalent with claims of the miraculous, is all such claims bear witness against themselves because they claim in an actually contradictory fashion to violate the very known laws of nature for which there is no violation other than discovering a new law which itself is naturalistically grounded. Let me give you the best example. For instance, in biblical times, people thought that mental illness was the product of demonic possession. So Jesus supposedly did exorcisms. But we know today that mental illness is the product of a chemical imbalance in the brain, other naturalistic causes. So every time that something has been in history attributed to a supernatural underpinning, advance in science and empirical investigation has always demonstrated that that's not true. There's also another major problem with claims of the supernatural, and that is involved in the notion of divine hiddenness. If there really is a banger, and if there really is a dice thrower, such a being should not then again play dice with our knowledge and should be more directly amenable to direct experience. But we have no corresponding evidence of the types of miracles that allegedly occurred in the Bible happening today.
If I'm just a natural object subject to the laws of nature, then all of my behavior is completely determined by my genetic structure in my body and by my environmental inputs. That means that I have absolutely no responsibility for my actions of murder or child molestation. Okay. It is only if I am a transcendent supernatural being. That is, it is only if I have a soul that's different from my body, that is invisible and a part of the supernatural world, that can act transcendent to that supernatural world. Every time I act freely, I inject power and force into my body and into the natural world. It's only if that is true that there can even be a discipline called law.
My response is to bring it back to what we are debating. We're debating, is there a supernatural? JP was trying to bootstrap the supernatural just because human beings have free will. Once again, what he has failed to do is to draw any kind of connection, to draw any kind of connection between proof of the supernatural. He's taking a natural phenomenon such as human consciousness, such as human awareness, which the overwhelming weight of the evidence shows to be a byproduct, an epiphenomenon of the brain, and he's saying because of that, we have to say that there's a transcendental underlying force, otherwise we wouldn't have free will. There's absolutely no connection between our ability as sentient beings to make choices and having to say that those choices are contingent upon an underlying supernatural order for which there is no evidence.
Okay, let's get JP's response.
Yeah, he misunderstands. First of all, bootstrapping is a philosophical trick to label my argument with a bad name. It's not bootstrapping, it's a cumulative case argument. Secondly, he failed to understand the argument. I wasn't arguing that there has to be a God because I exercise freedom. I was arguing based on Eddie's own definition of what it means to be a part of the natural world, that because I am free, and by the way, he said my actions are mere epiphenomena, that means they're totally determined by the brain, which grants my point. I'm arguing that because I am not determined, but I actually am free, that my own self or my own ego is a part of the supernatural world. But the second thing is that the human self or soul, because we have free will, transcends the laws of nature and acts miraculously by interrupting and intervening in those laws every time we act freely. Third, there have been miracles that have been verified in the history of the world, including today.
Jesus of Nazareth's career and his resurrection can be verified by any standard means of historical investigation. And today there are thousands of healings that are happening all over the world in the enterprise of the Christian church.
Well, there you have it. Now, don't be overwhelmed by the terminology, the debate back and forth. Let me summarize a little bit for you. JP's whole argument is the three lines of evidence that we've been talking about, that the universe had a beginning, it had a sufficient cause that had to lead back for the universe to jump into existence. There had to be a sufficient cause to cause that to happen, and Christians believe that's the Big Bang or God. And then he also talked about something called the anthropic principle. Let me flesh that out for you. The universe had a first cause. It's not eternal. The anthropic principle says when you look at nature all around you, we are just at the right tilt of axis from the sun, not too far away that we're freezing to death, and yet not too close that we're burning up, that we're just the right distance from the sun. And just that, taking that as an example, we know that that's a principle that shows purpose, that shows design, and shows intelligence. The anthropic principle is arguing for just these certain factors for life on Earth, just the right elements there for air, oxygen, for breathing, for living, that all of these elements just didn't happen by chance. It shows purpose. It shows a purpose for us being here. All the right conditions, the right distance from the sun, the right environment for life on the earth, it shows purpose. It shows providence. It shows the hand of God in many ways. Many, many scientists have come to this conclusion. So the first cause of the universe, the anthropic principle. These are lines of evidence that shows that there is a God. I think these are good answers to the atheist who tries to say everything is naturalistic, that really in the end, the only thing that is real is matter. There is no supernatural. There is no spirit world, in other words. So I think the evidence is in the Christian's favor when you listen to the evidence the way that it is presented. Well, I want to take us to another soundbite. I'm doing these several soundbites to kind of bring all of these arguments together. So at the end of the day, when you've heard them all, you'll begin to start thinking this way, and it'll become part of you and will help you the next time you talk to someone that is a skeptic. So this is from a book called God's Not Dead. It's evidence for a creator, and I think this will kind of sum up everything we've been talking about today on the cross in the desert. Let's listen.
In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. There's no question in scientists' minds that there was a beginning. But what they can't answer is how it began. Or more importantly, why? Why is there something rather than nothing? Is the universe merely a product of random chance? Or does it reflect the order and information that speaks of an intelligent mind behind it all? Some have suggested that the universe could pop into existence out of nothing. But what they fail to tell you is that in quantum terms, nothing isn't really nothing. It includes the laws of physics. So you either believe in an eternal set of laws or an eternal law giver. Then there's the question of life, and how did it begin? Some scientists and philosophers say that evolution can explain it all. Unfortunately, evolution is a theory that only tells you what happens once you have life. It can't tell you how it began. The chances that it could have happened by chance is staggering. Have you ever pocket texted someone by accident? You might get a few letters that are strung together that make no sense. If someone texted you and said, "Don't tell anyone, but I cheated on the test," the chances you could claim you pocket texted that would be extremely low. But what if it was an ordered sentence of 3 billion letters? That's the intelligent information in our human genome, in our DNA. The most accurate statement about us as humans is that we are fearfully and wonderfully made. And for the question of why we are here, we were created for relationship. Relationship with God and relationship with each other. But something happened to this wonderful creation. A virus was introduced into the system called evil. Evil is the opposite of good, and evil is a choice. It is a wrong choice. The evidence of morality itself, again, points to the God that made us. Because without God, there would be no basis for morality. As the Russian writer Dostoevsky said, if there is no God, then all things are permissible. But why would a loving God allow evil? It was the risk he took to give mankind a real freedom to choose, and evil would not have the last word. God entered his own creation as a man, Jesus Christ. He lived the life we should have lived by choosing to do good and not evil. And he died the death we should have died in our place. He took the punishment for our evil upon himself on the cross. And 3 days later, he rose again from the dead, proving he was the Son of God. And he ultimately broke the power of evil over us. As Jesus said, I was dead, but I'm alive forevermore. I have the keys of death and hell. And it's when Christ comes to live inside of us that we get the ultimate proof that he indeed exists. The God that created the galaxies lives on the inside of every heart that believes the gospel. And he is ready to roar like a lion. God's not dead.
There you have it on the cross in the desert. That's an excellent summary of the Christian worldview in 3 minutes or less. And I think that that's one of the best summaries I've heard. I think that this is so important for us that we can give answers for our faith. I love the way that Jesus put it. He said to his disciples on the night before his crucifixion, when Philip says, you know, show us the Father, show us the way, Jesus says, I am the way and the truth and the life. Few words that Christ used, but they have incredible, incredible ramifications. I am the way, not a way, the way, the truth. If you're looking for truth, Jesus says, look to me. And the life, if you need life, if you're looking for life, if you're looking for purpose, Jesus said, I am the way and the truth, and the life. He's pointing not to a philosophy. He's pointing to a person himself. He says, if you're looking for the way, I'm the way. If you're desperate and hungry for truth and meaning and purpose, I am the truth. And if you're in need of life, new beginning, I'm the life. So sum it up. What the world needs is Jesus. Not a religion, but a relationship, as I always say. And Jesus made it very, very clear standing before Pilate that all who are on the side of the truth will come to me. And one day, Pilate will stand before Jesus. So there you have it, here in this short time together, giving you some good resources in the intellectual world to give reasons and evidences for the hope that lies within you. I want to close out this segment of the program and let you hear the song by the Newsboys based on the movie God's Not Dead. When we finish that song, we're going to come back real quick, and I'm going to wrap it up from a reading from the book of Acts that will summarize what we've been saying here. So let's listen to the Newsboys right now on the cross in the desert with God's Not Dead.
In a statement released today, scientists have announced that based on their research, they have concluded that God is a myth.
I love the
God's not dead right here on the cross in the desert. What I want to do is take us to the Word of God, to the Bible, to the book of Acts, and I want to show you how the Apostle Paul, when he went to the seat of philosophy in Athens, Greece, how did he approach the skeptics of his day? What did he do? What did he say that made a difference in their thinking? You know, what I like about this text is that Paul took apologetics right into the marketplace. So we're going to read right now from Acts chapter 17, verse 16. While Paul was waiting for them in Athens, he was deeply troubled by all the idols he saw everywhere in the city. He went to the synagogue to reason with the Jews and the God-fearing Gentiles, and he spoke daily in the public square to all who happened to be there. He also had a debate with some of the Epicurean and Stoic philosophers. When he told them about Jesus and his resurrection, they said, "What's this babbler trying to say with these strange ideas he's picked up?" Others said, "He seems to be preaching about some foreign gods." Then they took him to the high council of the city. "Come and tell us about this new teaching," they said. "You are saying some rather strange things, and we want to know what it's all about." Quote, "It should be explained that all the Athenians, as well as the foreigners of Athens, seem to spend all their time discussing the latest ideas. So Paul, standing before the council, addressed them as follows. Men of Athens, I notice that you are very religious in every way. For as I was walking along, I saw your many shrines, and one of your altars had the inscription on it, quote, to an unknown god. This god whom you worship without knowing is the one I'm telling you about. He is the god who made the world and everything in it. And since he is Lord of heaven and earth, he doesn't live in man-made temples. And human hands can't serve his needs, for he has no needs. He himself gives life and breath to everything, and he satisfies every need. From one man he created all the nations throughout the whole earth. He decided beforehand when they should rise and fall, and he determined their boundaries. His purpose was for the nations to seek after God and perhaps feel their way toward him and find him, though he is not far from any one of us. For in him we live and move and exist, as some of your own philosophers has said, our poets. We are his offspring, and since this is true, we shouldn't think of God as an idol designed by craftsmen from gold or silver or stone. God overlooked people's ignorance about these things in earlier times, but now he commands everyone everywhere to repent of their sins and turn to him, for he has set a day for judging the world with justice by the man he has appointed, and he approved to everyone who this is by raising him from the dead. Now, when they heard Paul speak about the resurrection of the dead, some laughed in contempt, but others said, we want to hear more about this later. Very briefly, I want to point out some things about Paul's address to the Athenians. First of all, he confronted their idolatry. He showed them that God is not an idol in a temple, that he's a creator, and that God is not just some philosophical idea. He is an intelligent creator. And I love the way that Paul approached them with respect, just as Peter says we should do. Paul himself walked into the marketplace. He didn't hide behind church walls. He walked into the place of philosophy, of debates, and the Stoics and all these different groups that gathered together to babble about the latest fads of the culture. Paul confronted it. He showed that God is the creator. He shows that we're accountable to him. I love the way that he quoted from their own poets. Paul was not afraid to quote from them and showed the truth claim behind that quote, saying, look, your own poets have said, in this being we live and move and have our being. Let me tell you about this being that your poet talks about. And then he made the case for God as the creator. He goes from that to show that empires rise and fall by the providence of God, that where we live has been arranged by God, and that one day there will be an accounting for sin, and that God is the just God of the universe. So in just a short speech, and we don't have the whole speech here, in this short speech, Paul has made the case for the Christian worldview. He included the gospel of resurrection from the dead. These philosophers didn't know how to respond, certainly because they believed in the reincarnation of the soul, but not a physical bodily resurrection. So God, through Paul, is confronting these pagan ideas and these pagan worldviews. And when you see Paul in the marketplace here in Athens, I want you to see yourself there too, because that's where you and me have to go. We have to go out beyond the church walls. We have to go out of our comfort zone. We have to go into the marketplace and confront the ideas and the philosophies of our day. You see, that's our responsibility. They will never hear any other way. How will they hear? If we stay comfortable, if we stay in our comfort zone. You see, it requires a little work. It requires a little study. But what this text says to me is that we as Christians, as salt and light, as lights of the world, as Jesus said we are, that we need to go out to our culture and tell them what the Christian worldview is, to reason with them, truth to them. Jesus tells us to do this. He sends us out as sheep among wolves. But we are going with the rich treasure of the gospel. And this text tells me there are many, many creative ways we have in bringing home the truth of who God is to an unbelieving culture. Paul shows one way. He read from their poets. What does that mean? We as Christians should be able to quote from the philosophers and atheists of our day, taking their very quotes and their very words and critiquing them and showing the absurdity of them in a respectful way. So that tells me in this text that we can do that, that we need to study the unbelievers and understand where they're coming from in order for a way for us to persuade them. We need to learn from them in that sense, that we understand what they believe and why they believe it and be able to show the inadequacy of that belief system. That's what we as Christians are called to do. And ultimately, all that we say and do culminates in the presentation of the gospel. You see, I believe in giving reasons and answers for the faith, that as we do, we are making stepping stones toward the most important thing we can share with the unbelieving world, and that is the good news of Christ. So I hope this program today, a little different from anything I've ever done with you before, I hope this will serve as a persuasive way for you to think deeply about your faith, for you to think of creative ways of talking to unbelievers. You know, it's movies like God's Not Dead that come along every once in a while that kind of shakes us and wakes us, and it should. Because sometimes we get so complacent, and sometimes we get so comfortable in our Christian churches that we need to have a movie like this to shake us and say, look, we can stand for the truth. We can stand in a hostile environment, and we can give good, solid reasons for why we believe what we believe. So I hope in many ways that I've done that today, that I've encouraged you, stimulated you, and persuaded you to give answers for your Christian faith. As always, if you have any questions, please come to my Facebook page, Randy L. Noble. There are petitions and there are articles about what's happening in Iran. And that's my love and passion. So if you want to learn more about it, please come to my Facebook page and please friend request me. I'd be happy to be your friend. It has been truly an honor to spend this time this morning with you on the cross in the desert. Please keep Rahana Jabari and Saeed Abedini in your prayers. And please sign the petition if you haven't done so before. It's so important to speak out and pray for these situations. I pray that you have an incredible week. I will see you next time on the Cross into the Desert this Thursday. God bless you and have a great day. We'll see you very soon once again.
Healing rain.